It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, let's dive in, starting with the elections that we just had.
Yes, indeed. We got the results of the elections on Tuesday, and there were some not-so-big surprises and some otherwise really big surprises.
And a lot of fairly good news,
yeah,
actually.
One of the good pieces of news is that Dow Constantine won out over Susan Hutchinson for county executive.
Hutchison. There's no N.
I know. Did I say Hutchinson?
Yes, you did.
Oh, darn. Yeah.
And she is not to be confused with Ken Hutcherson.
What?
He's not
running for anything, is he?
Well, he basically was. He's the radically conservative Christian pastor on the east side, and that's basically what you would have gotten as King County executive if Susan Hutchison had won.
Uh-huh.
But fortunately, even though I tend to agree with my colleague at Horse's Ass, David Goldstein, who called Hutchison's campaign the most dishonest local campaign ever, because she basically lied about who she is, what her background was, and what she stood for all the way from the beginning to the end of the campaign, and most local media let her get away with it. And so the fact that she went from being ahead in the polls a month out to losing resoundingly. The last ballot drop I saw had her down by 17 points. Is really a fairly pleasing commentary on the intelligence of the electorate.
Yeah, I noticed that she didn't fool anybody. One of the interesting things, too, I saw is that her colleague in crime, Sheriff Sue Rahr, who had appeared with her in a public appearance, sort of like a campaign endorsement before the election. Sue Rahr had the most write-in votes against her than any other candidate in the King County and city race.
I hope she gets an opponent next time. I think any elected official should have opponents in races. I don't think any of them should run unopposed, but I think she in particular is very deserving of a challenge next time around.
Yeah, it would be good.
Yeah. The other pleasing commentary on the electorate came with Tim Eymann's I-1033, and really I only have one word for Tim Eymann, although it's repeated a number of times, which is ha ha ha. 1033 was very interesting in its returns, in that unlike Eymann's most recent off-year initiative, 960, which passed a couple of years ago, something like 52-48, with 1033, it went down actually in half of the counties east of the mountains, primarily rural counties. And what that suggests, among counties that normally would support a tax cutting initiative, no matter how destructive it is to social services, is that people have finally figured out in the rural communities of eastern Washington and down in the logging areas of, you know, Lewis and Grays Harbor counties and so forth, that when you cut government services, it actually hurts those small communities a lot more than it hurts the populous cities of the east side, because those communities are much more dependent on social services, on government spending, and even on infrastructure things like roads than larger communities.
Yeah, those rural communities get a lot of their revenue from the state. The state gives a lot of the money to those local communities, a lot more than it does to as a percentage of their revenue than it does for the big cities. So those communities are finally getting the message, oh yeah, if we vote for these things, oh my God, we won't have anything.
And that suggests in turn that Eymann's capacity to do future such tax cutting initiatives is going to be constrained quite a bit, because once you lose those votes, it's going to be very hard for him to get them back. And since he has already lost a lot of his grassroots network of the last decade or so ago, his last several campaigns have been almost entirely funded by an East Side millionaire named William Dunmire. And if either Dunmire or Eymann figures out that nobody's going to vote for these anymore, doesn't mean they'll stop doing it in terms of Eymann, because he makes his living at it, but it might mean that Dunmire stops throwing millions of dollars at initiatives that are almost guaranteed to lose.
Yeah, so the question is, will those initiatives even get on the ballot in the future? Another piece of good news is Referendum 71 was approved. That's the referendum that was basically a popular vote on whether or not the state should go ahead with a bill that was passed in the legislature to extend benefits to same-sex couples, basically the all-but-marriage Referendum 71. That passed by a huge margin, 67-33% last time I checked.
Yeah, and it was also very interesting that nationally, even though this was actually the first statewide vote that gives that level of privileges and responsibilities to both heterosexual and and gay
domestic registered partnerships,
but is casted primarily as a referendum on gay rights. And the national coverage almost exclusively focused on the question one in Maine, in which backers failed in their attempt to legalize gay marriage in that state, even though Washington State has five times the population of Maine and 71 won resoundingly. And there were a number of other very good pieces of news for gay rights around the country, most notably, I think, in Houston, where an openly gay person was the leader in the mayoral campaign. She didn't get the 50%, so she goes into a runoff. But if that can happen in Houston, Texas, it can happen anywhere.
Yeah.
It's very, very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Some other good news also, winners in, for example, the Port of Seattle, trucker Rob Holland beat out David Dowd, the investment properties broker for position number three.
Yeah, and Dowd was very open about essentially being a tool of big business and you know, wanting to represent those interests as though they haven't already been amply represented in the Port of Seattle. A race that I thought was good news that didn't get much attention was Peter Holmes beating out Tom Carr for city attorney.
Yeah, and by a wide margin,
and
almost
by a
double Carr's vote, which I thought was basically saying, well, we didn't like that clampdown on Seattle's nightlife that Tom Carr
undertook.
Well,
they didn't, and the Sidran-like interpretation of laws is encouraging civility laws. I mean,
exactly.
Carr turned out
giving the mayor the okay to do these homeless encampment sweeps, all kinds of things that Carr has done.
Yeah,
that has
and
been good.
And basically, when Carr first ran for office 8 years ago, it was with the promise of not being Mark Sidran, and it turned out that he was very much Mark Sidran, just without the love of publicity. And this basically was a referendum on those policies and that approach, and it was rejected resoundingly, which was, again, very good news.
Yeah, and then when we look at the city council races, we've got two incumbents returning, Conlon and Licata, and then two new folks to replace the most conservative members who are retiring. That would be Richard McIver and Jan Drago. The people who are replacing them are going to be Sally Bagshaw, not necessarily great news. She beat out David Bloom, who we endorsed, and Mike O'Brien in what looks like a pretty good win over Robert Rosencrantz.
Yeah, Rosencrantz was probably the most conservative person running for council this year, and O'Brien, of course, is not the former head of the Sierra Club, and so that piece is good news. Bagshaw being on council, she probably will inherit Drago's role of being the conservative tool of downtown business. She's a very close
with
ally.
With less experience.
With less
that,
experience.
Mm-hmm.
She is a very close ally of Mayor Nichols and was originally running for council to be his surrogate on council, really. And then when Nichols didn't survive the primary, a lot of the resources that would have gone into his reelection campaign their way to her campaign instead. So David Bloom really never had much of a chance, which is really unfortunate.
Because he was a good candidate. Yeah, so we'll see how that changes or affects the dynamics on the city council, having Bagshaw come in to replace Drago, a pretty close approximation of Jan Drago's policies, but then Mike O'Brien, who might change the dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, goodness knows that. I mean, O'Brien is really more of an environmentalist than a social justice activist, but Nick Licata has been carrying the mantle of progressivism alone on the council ever since Steinbrook left, 4 years ago now?
Or, yeah, it's been well,
no, 2 years
two
ago.
Years.
I'm sorry,
been 4 years
yet. But he announced early that he wasn't seeking re-election.
Mm-hmm.
But Licata could sure use some company on city council for what will probably be his last term. And progressives who are looking at changing the dynamic of council should start thinking now about 2011 because, you know, it takes money to run these races. And unfortunately, as we saw with Bloom's campaign and with Joe Swaya's 2 years ago, when you're running against downtown interests personified in a candidate like Bagshaw, you have to have some resources or it's not going to be a competitive race.
All right. That moves us on to national news and the tragedy of Fort Hood.
Yeah, Major Nidal Hassan, the 39-year-old military psychiatrist who shot and killed 12 people and wounded 30-some folks at Fort Hood. I thought it was kind of interesting when the news first broke and the military spokespeople said, oh, you know, as far as we know, he has no religious affiliation. And then a day later, it comes out, well, he was a very devout devout Muslim. He's a first-generation American, born of parents who had emigrated from Palestine. And
reportedly gotten a lot of harassment in the army because he was Muslim.
Because he was Muslim. And if the official folks at the U.S. military didn't know what his religious affiliation was, his colleagues sure did. And what I found interesting, too, is that there was almost no coverage of the fact that here's a man who had post-traumatic stress disorder from treating troops who were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who had severe mental health issues. He had seen severely wounded troops, which in itself can give you PTSD, as many medical professionals can tell you.
He had to listen to horrible, horrible stories
day
of things
after
that had happened over there.
Day after day. He was openly against the war. I think this case really shows you that even though they call it a voluntary army, you can certainly sign up voluntarily, but there is no way you can voluntarily get out of it, and there is no humane or even no set standard or policy for how to deal with folks who need to get out of the armed forces for one reason or another, if it's for health reasons, if it's because they need a leave of absence to take care of family matters. When Dar Jamail was in town and he was talking about the status of U.S. forces with the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the extremely high rates of PTSD and the fact that the military has no way to deal with these folks, how to let them leave because and when they need to, or even how to get them the help that they need, the psychological help that they need, and that a lot of these folks are being kept in the military in units that will eventually be mustered and sent back over to Iraq or Afghanistan, folks who are mentally ill, guys who have gone AWOL, men and women who are resistors who do not want to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, who, as Major Hassan said to his superiors, have openly opposed the wars from the beginning. Those folks are being kept in the military, and they are now being mustered and sent over to Iraq and Afghanistan, even though by any standard they should not be.
Yeah, Hassan had tried several times to actually leave the army, and they wouldn't let him. A number of things jumped out at this from this tragedy to me. One, of course, just the overall arc that this is part of the horror of war, that it filters down in any number of ways, and this is one of them. The soldiers who died at Fort Hood were every bit as much casualties of this war as anybody who died in Iraq, Afghanistan. That being said, the amount of media attention that is being given to this, that compared to, say, a wedding party in Afghanistan where, you know, dozens of people die, because there are soldiers and it's on American soil, suddenly it becomes incredibly tragic when lives in Iraq and Afghanistan are just as important and mean just as much. The other thing about media coverage that's striking me is we're starting to get these reports, particularly this morning, of the police officer who was first on the scene, and she's being hailed as a hero for taking Hassan down. And this is probably accurate, and you know, if true, she did great things. But in the wake of incidents like Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch, there's this little voice in my head that's intrinsically disbelieving any time I hear a story of militarism, of heroism out of the military. And that's a really unfortunate byproduct of what happened under the Bush administration, and by people who thought public relations was more important than telling the truth.
Yeah, and I just see this all as an indication of the strain that the military is under, that the troops in the military are under, having to do repeat deployments to they return from Iraq, they turn around, they get sent to Afghanistan. Many of them signed contracts for a limited amount of time in the military, and those contracts have been revoked under the stop loss program. So folks,
or they were in the reserves of the National Guard and not even thinking they were up for something like this.
Right, and they're spending 3, 4, 5 tours over there. And they come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, they come back with wounds, and they're patched up haphazardly and sent back. And that's just not a good sign. I think it's a sign that we're going to see more of this.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the big economic news this week was the jobs report yesterday. The Labor Department released its figures for official unemployment. It's now over 10% at 10.2%, and it hit 10% much sooner than most economists expected. They were saying earlier this year that, oh, we expect 10% unemployment by 2010, that's next year, not by October of this year, and that's what's happened. But I also want to point out, as we have many times in this program, that unemployment statistics only count the officially unemployed. In this case, the Labor Department was only counting company payrolls. That doesn't count the self-employed, independent contractors, temps, and it undercounts small businesses, which account for something like 60% of the jobs in the United States. Real unemployment is much, much higher. That's only a best guess. And the Labor Department put that best guess at about 17% to 18%, although in many states, and I've seen other analysts say that they think it's over 20%. Now, a lot of them say that the Great Depression official unemployment was between 20% and 30%. So we are entering the realm of the 1930s here.
Yeah, at a time in the 1930s where unemployment statistics were much more honest because they hadn't, you know, the criteria for it hadn't been steadily revised downward over the years the way it has now.
Yeah, yeah. And this comes after happy talk about retail sales being so much better. Well, if you looked at that report, you would have seen that the revival in retail sales was led by high-end luxury retailers, which means that folks who are heavily invested in the stock market have benefited from the run-up in stock prices, and so they're spending more money. But the rest of us, not so much. So, there was that report this week. Other stuff in regards to economic news. The Senate this week approved an extension of unemployment benefits just in the nick of time because in October, more than 500,000 people, somewhere around 600,000 people, had run out of unemployment benefits. So this extension is going to give people another 14 to 20 weeks of additional benefits, depending on which state you live in. If your state has a high unemployment rate, then you get 20 weeks. If it's got a low unemployment rate, you get about 14 weeks of additional benefits. Excuse me. But there were some other things attached to this bill that were not so good. It also extended the $8,000 first-time home buyer credit for an additional 5 months past its November 30th expiration date. But it also did another thing. It created a new $6,500 credit for current homeowners to buy a new home if they've been living in their current home for 5 years. In other words, it extended the credit to everybody, pretty much. It also raised the income limits to qualify for the credits. In order to qualify for the first-time home buyer credit, you had to be an individual who made up to $75,000 a year, or if you were a couple, you could make up to about, $150,000 a year. Now, to qualify, all you need to do is be an individual who makes up to $125,000 a year, or a couple that makes up to $225,000 a year. So essentially, what these two credits do now is they're just propping up the real estate market. In other words, it's a bailout of the real estate industry, and it's not giving money to people who need it. It's just giving money away to whoever wants it. In addition, that bill also extended the net operating loss carryback from 2 years to 5 years. In essence, what it did was it said any business that takes a loss, and this is not just small businesses as the NOL was extended to before, it's any business that takes a loss in 2009 now can take that loss. They can amend their tax returns back 5 years and apply that loss to their profits from, you know, 5 years, you know, in the last 5 years, and they can get a massive tax refund for those 5 years.
So what we're getting, basically, I mean, with the combination of all of those moves is welfare for the well-off and a concerted effort, which we've talked about on this show before, to reinflate past bubbles.
Oh, yeah, to reinflate the housing market bubble.
We're not getting any kind of a real effort at reform that would stop the kind of economic collapse that has happened in the last year from happening again.
No, and in fact, in terms of financial reform, the House Financial Services Committee voted this week to repeal a major part of the 2002 Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which was passed in the wake of the Enron and WorldCom scandals. Sarbanes-Oxley had increased the reporting requirements so that investors and regular folks like you and me could see what major corporations were up to. Well, now that no longer applies to most small and medium-sized businesses, and the House Financial Services Committee is going to set up another committee to review whether or not to repeal Sarbanes-Oxley in relation to large corporations as well. So instead of getting
more...
Bear
in mind, Sarbanes-Oxley was wholly inadequate when it was passed.
Oh, yeah, it was not enough.
But big companies have been lobbying to get it repealed ever since.
Yeah, and so now they're using the whole economic downturn as an excuse to deregulate even more.
All right, moving on, healthcare.
Yeah, big vote coming up potentially today, if not today, then Monday in the House of Representatives. This could be the end of the healthcare reform debate. Democrats, at this moment anyway, do not have enough votes to pass the bill, and that's because some 50 Democrats, and Nancy Pelosi can't afford more than 40 to defect, some 50 have said or indicated that they're likely to vote no on the final House bill. That includes Brian Baird in the state of Washington, so anybody who's living in his district, which is basically Olympia and to the south, needs to give Baird's office a call and lean heavily on him this morning. Adam Smith in the 9th, which is a suburban district that goes all the way from South King County around Tacoma and down to the edge of Olympia, is also said to be wavering, so his folks should be particularly mobilized as well. But really, anybody should be calling their congressional representative. Of course, Dave Reichert on the east side, all Republicans have said that they're going to vote no on this. But it really underscores there are any number of reasons why Democrats are saying they're going to vote no. Some are anti-choice, although apparently late last night there was a deal made between the Democrats who are opposed to abortion and advocates for the bill that would allow amendments that would ensure that no abortions would be paid for under insurance policies in the public option that's in this bill. There are members of the Hispanic caucus who want undocumented workers to have access to provisions of the bill. There are single-payer advocates who either want their promised vote on that issue or think this reform will enshod a flawed system entirely. There are members who object to a surtax on millionaires. There are members who don't want more government involvement in the healthcare industries. And then there are just, you know, weasels and scared cats. And there are some Democrats who are in multiple camps as well. So it really underscores how Obama and Pelosi have not done a good job of keeping the Democrats in line with anywhere near the unanimity that you see amongst the Republicans who are opposed to this bill. And it also underscores how even if this passes the House, it makes the House's negotiating position and what is already a pretty flawed bill that much weaker compared to the Senate version of the bill, which if it passes is going to be watered down even more. So what this all means is that even if we get health care reform, it might help, but it will be nowhere near what we actually need.
All right. And briefly, the terrorist watch list.
Yeah. Washington Post report this week, 400,000 names on the FBI's terror watch list now, which probably includes everybody listening to the sound of our voices.
All right. Moving on to international and peace talks.
Yeah, a lot going on in the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. They pretty much had a major meltdown this week when first Hillary Clinton came along and opened her mouth and said, gosh, look, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli president, has offered to not freeze settlements, but to stall in building a few settlements, so in building new settlements for about a year, meaning it's the same old with the Israeli.
So freeze and rapidly expand basically mean the same thing, is that
pretty
correct?
Pretty much, yeah. Basically, yeah. It's just all talk, and the Palestinians groaned and clutched their head and said, "Is nothing ever going to change here?" And then Abbas, the Palestinian president, announced that, I'm sorry, I'm 74 years old and I just can't run for re-election anymore, never mind the fact I have no constituency anymore. So essentially, the Middle East peace talks, which Obama had said he was going to make a major push and really get them started and get them resolved, well, nope, it's not happening.
All right. And Italy.
Yeah, an Italian judge convicting 23 CIA agents of the kidnapping a few years ago of Egyptian national Abu Omar and renditioning him to a torture prison of undisclosed location. This is what, and of course those agents were all convicted in absentia because they're back in the U.S. and the Italian government has been refusing for political reasons to order their extradition. But it does underscore what happens when a justice system is actually willing to prosecute crimes, regardless of who the criminals are, and we could actually learn something from that.
All right, and finally, Honduras.
Yeah, we mentioned last week that there was an agreement between ousted President Zelaya and the coup leaders in Honduras. That agreement has collapsed over this past week over the coup allies in Congress refusing to spell out the conditions by which Zelaya would be reinstated. His term expires at the end of this month with an election on the 29th of November. He's term limited from running again, and therefore likely he won't be reinstated before the election. And this throws a cloud over the whole legitimacy of that election process as well.
All right. And events.
Yeah, several of them to talk about. Malalai Joya, the wonderful Afghan former MP and feminist who was mentioned in, for her CNN appearance on Counterspin last half hour. She is going to be in Seattle on Wednesday. That'll be 7 o'clock at Seattle First Baptist Church, 1111 Harvard Avenue on Capitol Hill. Well worth checking out. That's Wednesday night, Malalai Joya. Thursday night, Ray McGovern, the noted CIA, former CIA agent and security and intelligence analyst, will be at Kane Hall, room 220, 7 o'clock. And then Friday night, Eat the State is having a benefit. And what happens is that this coming week it will be my 50th birthday. That's right, I'm getting to be an old man. And so people are going to roast me. And among the roasters will be two other people in this room. So if you barely tolerate the political stuff on this program and really only, tune that out, but you basically listen to, because you like to hear us ridicule each other, well, this event is for you.
Ridicule each other and public figures.
Yes, exactly. But a number of really good people will be there. Tim Harris from Real Change will be one of the roasters. Also, David Goldstein of Horse's Ass. Former school board president Brita Butler-Wall will be there. Canute Berger of KUOW and Crosscut. And, of course, Mike and Maria and Lance Scott from Eat the State. I should be put in my place. That is pretty much clear. But it is a benefit for Eat the State. Tickets are $15 or 2 for $25. You can probably talk your way in. We're not going to be.
And where is it again?
Firm about that. And it is in the U District at University Baptist Church, 47th and 12th Northeast in the U District. 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. I would suggest getting there early because parking in that neighborhood
on November 13th. That's next Friday.
Yes,
right?
Parking in that neighborhood is not great on the street, and it is next Friday night, November 13th. So please come Friday night. It'll be a good time, and a lot of I think a pretty large cross section of Seattle's activist community is going to be there. So it's turning out, shaping up like it's going to be quite the event. So
yeah,
please come.
I've been splitting wood all week for the roast. So
I've been marinating my barbecue sauce.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town where you find all sorts of free periodicals in bars, bookshops, cafes, coffee shops, etc. You can also find us in the King County Public Library system, and we can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.